I'm Jenny.
And I'm Scott.
Welcome to the third episode of the Reading Envy podcast.
Wow, three episodes.
Three.
We'll have what you're reading.
Yes, please.
Mm-hmm.
And today we have one of our favorite readers.
Yeah.
Oh.
Sister Julie Loquacious. Podcaster extraordinaire.
Yes, yes.
Hi, Julie.
Hello.
Yeah.
Hello.
She does a podcast that, you know, some people might like called A Good Story is Hard to Find.
That sounds
good. And someday I plan to listen to that myself and, and find out if it's any good at all.
Well, you'd love my co-host, Scott. He's the best.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. And she writes a wonderful blog called Happy Catholic.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. You know, I think I've told you this before, but, you know, I found you in two different ways at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
When I first met you, it was through SFF Audio, and I was also reading your blog, and I didn't realize that you were one person until one day it was like, oh my gosh, that's the same person.
It really surprised me when you said that, when you went, wait a minute, are you from Happy Catholic? It was like, you're on SFF Audio. You read Happy Catholic? That has, you know, that does not compute.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, so that was neat. That was neat.
And the third leg of her tripod is the Forgotten Classics.
Oh, that's right. Of course. Yeah.
It's a blog and a podcast, right? I mean, more or less?
Mostly it's a podcast. I mean, I could put things on there, but nobody ever goes to that blog, so I just podcast on there. But yeah. I read stories to people. That's where I give a little commentary before and after, but I'm just reading things to people I would like them to read, and since I couldn't push enough people into liking things by writing about them, I just read to them, hoping they will listen and go read these authors themselves.
I love that.
Yeah,
you're reading H. Rider Haggard's The People of the Mist right now.
I am.
I'm a little bit behind. I listened to part of chapter one so far. So I'm a few episodes behind. You're actually on chapters 5 and 6, it says.
Yes, and the next one, which I was listening to so I could edit it, is going to be 3 chapters in 1 episode. So we're going to get really far ahead.
Ooh.
But it's a very...
I love this. I love this. You say story rating, PG for scanty clothing, monstrous gods, rampant adventure, and an almost complete lack of sensitivity or multiculturalism. I love it. That's hilarious.
Well, it's H. Rider Haggard. I got to cover myself somehow. It's such a great adventure, but he was writing during the, what is it called, the colonial era?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. You know, there was a certain amount of insensitivity because they didn't know to be sensitive.
Well, cool.
But on the other hand, that book happens to have one of the coolest black characters ever named Otter. So.
Cool. Well, great. Well, why don't you take a sip of your sidecar and let us know what you've been reading.
Yes, please.
Okay, well, I have been reading a book called S by J.J. Abrams and Doug Dorst.
J.J. Abrams of Star Trek and Star Wars fame and Lost, and what else has he done?
Oh, my gosh.
Many things.
Yes, I think he helped start Person of Interest and all these TV shows and things, and he's got this dynamic sense of storytelling. It may not always play out, as those of us who quit watching Lost halfway through know. But this book makes me think of Lost in a book, in a way. And it's, let me just describe it physically first, which is that it looks like a 1949 book when you see it. Have either of you seen this book?
I have seen it once when you mentioned it on a Twitter or something. I looked at it.
Okay.
And it looks fascinating. But yeah, no, I have not held one in my hand.
Have you
seen
it,
Jenny? Pictures. Just pictures.
Okay. Well, the cover is, I mean, it's got that debossed and textured kind of linen type cover. The style is old. You open it up, the pages are old and yellowed around the edges as if it's a very old book. It's got book for loan stamped inside, and the back cover, it has all the library dates stamped onto it, you know. And then when you're leafing through it, there's an actual book, of course, but in all the margins are all these handwritten conversations between these two people. So it's a book within a book So you've got the story, which is called Ship of Theseus, or Theseus, however you say that name, by V.M. Straka. And Straka is this author, as you soon find out, who's very controversial, possibly a bit of a terrorist, and mysteriously died. Nobody knows what, why, or even what his real identity was. So you're reading the story, and it's a fascinating story, actually. It's really good.
Really?
And kind of...
So the story itself is cool.
Yeah, the story itself is good. And it's almost this science fiction-y horror type of a story. I don't want to describe too much, but I'm continually surprised by the things that are happening in it.
Oh, that's cool.
And then when you read around the edges, you have this blue and black handwritten conversation going on. Things are underlined, arrows are drawn, and it's between a guy who'd gone through and done a bunch of penciled notes, and this girl's found the notes, and she's commenting on them, and he comes back and starts commenting on her comments. And between them, they get to know each other and tell each other about their lives, and at the same time, they're starting to investigate who was this author. Which of the seven suspects was he?
And then, can you pick one of those notes and read it?
Let's see here.
Just so I can.
Jen says, "How long have you been studying Straka?" And I can't remember the guy's name. "Since I was in high school, I guess. 15 years." She says, "Ever wonder if you should be doing something else?" He says, "No." She says, "This is where an empathetic person might ask why." The guy says, "Why?" She says, "I'm graduating in May. No clue what to do next." The guy says, "Find what you love, then fight like hell when people try to take it away from you."
She says, wow, and this is all just in the margins
of
this.
Yeah, and it's obviously handwritten. And then later they'll break into something else where she'll have circled the word skullduggery, drawn arrow. I love this word. And then they start talking about loving words.
Oh, wow.
Oh, I need to read this book.
Yeah, they'll look at the footnotes and go, "This never happened." The translator of his books is another character who they're trying to figure out who she was. She was obviously in love with the author, but they really never met. So they're talking about how they had code to each other in it, of where they would meet each other. And then within these pages... Well, and there are three sets of notes, because then there's purple and red, and there's also orange and green. And I think there's a fourth set that's black and all caps, but I'm not positive yet. But then within the pages are also things like, here's a telegram that's in German and then been translated, just stuck in the pages of the book. Here's a postcard from Brazil. Birds on one side and a handwritten note on the other. Here's a six-page note. A letter from one of these people to the other one when they said in the margins, "I can't tell you this story of my life, too long." Well, two chapters later, they stick this note in the book.
Wow.
And it's all this backstory.
Well, that sounds pretty cool.
Yeah. So, and it's when you look on Amazon, all these people have written all their comments about how they read the book. How do you read it?
Uh-huh.
And so I was reading it the way most people say, which is you read a chapter of the book, then you go back and read the first set of notes. And it was kind of like having a movie on in the background while you listen to people talking. Sometimes they're talking about what's on TV, sometimes they're not. And it got so distracting that I think I'm going to just read the book itself and then go back through and start reading the first set of notes.
Wow.
So I guess this book doesn't probably have an audio version. I can't imagine trying
to
listen to it. I mean,
no, it doesn't have an ebook version and it doesn't have an audio version, but I thought I saw on Goodreads or somewhere that Will Wheaton was going to read the audio version, which I can't really imagine. He just doesn't seem right for it to me.
And
I was thinking about it going, how would you even put the notes in?
You'd have to do it in collaboration with the author, I think, to even understand how it should be read.
Yeah, because it's such a dynamic, you know, and it's one of those things where you get really involved with the pages, and it's like a love letter to books because it is so untranslatable to an ebook or to an audiobook. Whatever you do is going to be awkward. This is just something where after I looked at the version, I couldn't believe the library had it. And after I looked at the first version, I said, I'm going to get my own version because I would like it just as a piece of art in a sense.
Yeah.
And I wanted to make sure everything was in the right place. And then when I got it, I wrote it all down on post-its.
So the library had all the pieces? Did they have it like in a Ziploc baggie?
No, and that's when I discovered they only had about half the pieces.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Huh. Mm.
Because that's kind of what slowed me down, because I was having to say, well, I have an hour so I can read a chapter and all the notes, and I have to sit up because everything will fall out. So now I'm going to go out and just read the book. And if things fall out, I have my post-its. I can read it in bed and everything. So.
Wow.
But it's really...
Well, that is a heck of a cool idea.
Yeah, it's kind of like a game in a book or something. Mm-hmm. Which, and the author, I think J.J. Abrams came up with the idea and then worked with Doug Dorst, who was an author actually before this. So you can kind of trust that the story's well done.
Mm-hmm.
At least it seems like it. I'm fascinated. I can't wait to see what happens to this main character, S.
Here on Amazon, it says, you know, Doug Dorst, it says all the stuff you just said. And it also says, Dorst is also a 3-time Jeopardy champion.
Oh, that was, yeah.
How funny.
I know. I thought that was funny.
Good for him. That's great. Wow, that's fascinating. I'm going to definitely find that.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I'm definitely intrigued. That's cool.
So do you think you'll make it to the end, unlike Lost?
Oh, yeah. This is a book. I can do this. They have to have an end already, and they can't just keep adding seasons and telling me they'll answer that in 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
Well.
So who's next?
You're next.
Am I next?
What have you got? Are you next? I think you're next.
I'll go next.
Go ahead.
Go
yep.
for it.
So I have to give a little preamble to my book choice, because every year most people make New Year's resolutions, but I make reading goals. And one of mine was to read epistolary books, whether they are fiction or nonfiction. And epistolary, of course, is books written in letters. And so I came across this book where I work. I work at a library, and it's called Francis and Bernard by Carlene Bauer. I believe that's how you say her name. And I actually just came across it on accident, but it was short, so I grabbed it anyway. I, you know, sometimes go, oh, I don't have time. I have to read these other books. But I picked it up, and I didn't know anything about it. I don't know the author at all, but I could tell that it was written all in letters. So I was like, well, at least it'll meet my reading goal. And so I guess it's supposed to be inspired by the lives of Flannery O'Connor and Robert Lowell. And it's from the summer, well, it starts in the summer of 1957, and Francis and Bernard meet at a writer's colony of sorts, and they don't really get acquainted that much. They're kind of both on the surface, but then he writes her a letter, and she writes back, and they become really fast friends and kind of lifelong. And so the whole novel is told in letters. It's told mostly between letters between the two of them, but then also every once in a while, letters from their friends to them, or from them to their friends, or to other acquaintances that kind of fill in parts of the story. There's also an aspect of mental illness that I felt added a little bit of melodrama, maybe, that I didn't really need. I thought that the relationship was interesting enough. But I wonder, I don't know these authors. Well, one's an author, one's a poet. I don't know much about their actual lives. So it could come from that. I'm not really sure. But I don't know, I guess, you know, I think everyone has relationships that aren't exactly what they want them to be, whether it's like a parent or a friend that you've lost touch with, or, you know, lots of other types of relationships. And I think the relationship here is like that. You know, they both want things they can't have, and it comes through very emotionally in the letters. And I just loved it. It just kind of, like, I don't know, it just got to me really deep down. So I think it's going to be one of my favorite books of the year.
Wow, that's neat.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I've read an epistolary book. I'm trying to think of one other than Dracula.
Yeah. Well, and that one's like a, is that one a journal or is that letters?
It's both.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, it seemed to me I read an epistolary book recently, but I can't remember. But I have read, actually, The Habit of Being, which is Flannery O'Connor's, it's a collection of Flannery O'Connor's letters.
Oh, really?
Oh, it is really, it's huge. So it took me a while, because I would just dip into it. But by the time I got done, I'd kind of almost fallen in love with her because she was just such a wonderful letter writer. Very fair. Sometimes people were writing asking her about, you know, how can you write these stories and you're such a devout Catholic? And that's, I think, what I mean by fair, because she would never say, well, everybody should feel this way. She'd just go, here's how I understand things. And she had good explanations. But it also had letters from her to other writers who she was giving advice to, friends.
Were there any letters to Robert Lowell?
No, not that I can remember. I was trying to think about that, and I don't remember even hearing a hint of anything like that. She had
lupus. I'm going to track this down.
Yeah. Oh, it's really, I think you would enjoy it. I'd be curious to hear if the style was similar to the style that this author uses. She had lupus and lived with her mother for most of her adult life after she was out of school and a brief period of going off to writing colonies and things like that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I think most of this happens in the writing colony stage.
Mm-hmm.
So it's probably in between there. But okay, here's I have one little tiny quote example from a letter from Bernard to Francis. It just kind of demonstrates their type of relationship. I'm trying to look at you with love, but without illusions. I love your suspicion. Just cute. I like books that are cute. And it goes way deeper than cute, but it just, you know, made me smile a lot. So I think that's the last little bit about that one. Mm-hmm. So Scott.
Yes.
What books have you been reading?
The first one that I wanted to talk about is one that Brian mentioned last time that I went ahead and read. My first foray into postmodern literature.
Oh.
And I really have no idea what to say.
Uh-oh.
It's called The Crying of Lot 49 by Thomas Pynchon.
Oh.
Right.
Yeah, and it's a novella, so a short novel, and I mean, how do I describe it? It's about this lady named Oedipa Moss, who has a ex-boyfriend who passes away and leaves her to kind of figure out his estate. But while she's doing that, she's discovering something to do with these mail, you know, as in postal mail, two different entities that seem to, you know, in the old times used to compete for mail service. And, you know, this is a really highly regarded book, you know, I read it and was perplexed the whole time. And Brian said I was going to scratch my head. And I did. So I'm trying to understand what postmodern literature is and what the appeal of it is, because it's not quite with me. But I thought I'd read the first paragraph because I think it gives you a really good taste of this style. And I'll have to take a very deep breath. So here goes. One summer afternoon, Mrs. Oedipa Moss came home from a Tupperware party whose hostess had put perhaps too much kirsch in the fondue to find that she, Oedipa, had been named executor, or she supposed executrix, of the estate of one Pierce Inverarity, a California real estate mogul who had once lost $2 million in his spare time, but still had assets numerous and tangled enough to make the job of sorting it all out more than honorary. So that was one sentence.
Wow.
Oedipa stood in the living room, stared at by the greenish dead eye of the TV tube, spoke the name of God, tried to feel as drunk as possible, but this did not work. She thought of a hotel room in Mazatlan whose door had just been slammed, it seemed forever, waking up 200 birds down in a lobby. A sunrise over the library slope at Cornell University that nobody out on it had seen because the slope faces west. A dry, disconsolate tune from the fourth movement of the Bartok Concerto for Orchestra. A whitewashed bust of Jay Gould that Pierce kept over the bed on a shelf so narrow for it that she always had the hovering fear that it would someday topple on them. Was that how he died, she wondered, among dreams, crushed by the only icon in the house? That only made her laugh out loud and helpless. You're so sick, Oedipa, she told herself, or the room, which knew. So that was the first paragraph. So it's like that throughout. It's almost as if, and I realize that I'm looking at an entire class of literature with one example. But it seems as if in this book, the story is not the thing.
Right.
It's really Pynchon is the thing. So it's almost as if the main character of this book is not Oedipamos, who is practically in the entire book, but it is Pynchon. And it's like he's saying, you know, I don't know what he's saying specifically, but he's throwing out all this stuff. It's just like, you know, look at all this stuff in my head, and I'm just going to put it out here and look at how much it is. You know, I guess what I'm trying to say is it feels to me, you know, this differs from other pieces of fiction that I've read and enjoyed in that it's not so much the story is not the thing. It's just this constant stream of consciousness flow onto the page. And I know that this book is really highly regarded. I gave it 3 of 5 stars because, you know, there are parts of it where I read it and I'm just like, my goodness, you know, that was really something. But it's very stylistic, very dense. You could read it really slowly. You laugh sometimes. A lot of his names are funny.
Did you like it, though? I mean...
Did I like it? I had to push through it to the end because to me there wasn't really anything to grasp onto. And it may be because I have never read anything that I can compare this to. It's, you know, normally when I read a book, the thing that makes me want to push on is there's something in the story that really interests me. Yeah. In this, that was non-existent. The story was there. I didn't find it interesting in a way that, oh, I can't wait to see what happens next. What I was interested in is what is Pynchon going to say now? You know what I mean? And that was a kind of a stark difference. So it's like I got to a point where, you know, I could took it or left it.
That sounds terrible.
Well, no, I was thinking the opposite. Like when we were talking to Brian and he brought that book up, it was really funny because I had it sitting to the left of me.
Oh, like, that is funny.
I need to read that book because I've read Gravity's Rainbow and really loved it.
Now, Gravity's Rainbow. Now, this was a novella.
Right.
And Gravity's Rainbow, I mean, is it the same kind of a style? And it's much longer,
it's
right?
Much longer. There is vaguely some things going on. But, yeah, I mean, it's
vaguely some things going on.
You have to really kind
and last time you talked about David Foster Wallace, and I've heard you describe that book. And
well, what you're describing...
It seems the same kind of thing as this, or do you disagree with that?
Well, I think they all fall in the same really broad category, but for different reasons. And what you were describing kind of makes me think more of Nicholson Baker. There's this one book that he wrote called The Mezzanine, and the entire book is what the thoughts of a man as he's riding the escalator between two floors.
Wow, how long is it?
I mean, it's probably a little longer than a novella, but it's longer than you would think.
How about that?
Yeah, but I love stuff like that.
Like that movie, My Dinner with Andre, you know, which I know eventually they probably talked about something, but halfway through the movie, my husband and I just turned it off and went, you know, we could have dinner ourselves and have a conversation. We don't need to watch these people doing it, which I guess shows how shallow we are. I don't know. I'd like something to happen in my books.
Well, I think postmodern lit, I think it makes the most sense if you have a lot of grounding in it. I think there's kind of a progression you have to read to really understand what people are doing, because then you see where it comes from.
Would you compare this to something like modern art, which I also don't have any understanding of?
Sure. I mean, everything comes from somewhere else, but if you don't understand the things it's coming from, then it just seems like it's out of left field.
Yeah, and that's how I felt. I felt like it was just a collection of things from my head. That's how I felt.
But I bet it goes a lot deeper than that. I bet that
I would be surprised if it didn't, because it's so highly regarded. I know people teach this novel.
Right.
You know? But yeah, I don't know what to say.
When I read Ulysses, when I finally got through it, you know, it took me like 5 tries. But I read it along with some companion books. And the companion books were telling me all these things that I was not seeing. Like, this is how it relates to the Odyssey. This is how it relates, you know, and I'm just like, seriously. But at least with that one, you can enjoy it for the story and the changing styles. I'm not even sure if it would quite count as postmodern, but, you know, I think you can enjoy things for a lot of different reasons.
Yeah, and I think you can, too. This was a book, you know, one of the first books I've read in a long time in which I seem to have no connection whatsoever. It's like, you know, he's saying a lot of things. They seem to be pop culture things, some of it, you know. But it's not stuff that I have ever connected with. So there was really, you know, this author's probably not for me because, you know, I'm not, there's not a lot of stuff in here that I'm grabbing onto.
Right. But you tried it.
Oh, yeah, I tried it. And I'm glad that I did, you know, because now I know. But
yeah.
It's, yeah.
Or you'd have to take a class or something. It could almost be like, when we were discussing the Lord of the Rings, and I was saying, you know, it wasn't until I was listening to the Tolkien Professor podcast where I went, oh my gosh, here are all the levels that I never thought about before.
Right,
you
know, and so that could sure happen.
Yeah.
You could sure listen to a lecture or something and open it up.
Yeah, exactly. So.
Yeah, and that's that. So back to you, Julie.
Oh, well, I also have a book that's, well, no, it's not like that. But this book is called Bone Dance by Emma Bull.
I have heard of that one, but I have not read it.
Has anybody read anything by Emma Bull? She hasn't written a lot of books.
No, I don't know that name.
I have not.
Okay, she hasn't. Well, she's written several and edited them with her husband, Will Shetterly, I think is how you say his name. But she's only written just a few on her own, and I just love her style. This is a science fiction book. It's fantasy, I guess. The subtitle is A Fantasy for Technophiles. It's from, 1999, I think, something like that. My version is a reprint from 2009. Basically, it is set in a future that I mentally think of as a cross between Firefly, when they're landing on the big cities and you see these kind of odd, cobbled together, futuristic type, junky worlds, and
you
Blade Runner,
Firefly,
and maybe Almost Human if anybody's watching that. That kind of a situation, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The main character's name is Sparrow. Sparrow is somebody who loves, I would say, technology, but what Sparrow really loves are the things that technology provides in terms of story: movies, songs, books. And they're very difficult to get, but Sparrow's good at finding them for very rich clients who will pay a lot for $200 for a copy of Singing in the Rain, sort of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the only problem for Sparrow is Sparrow keeps having these blackout periods where suddenly coming back into consciousness makes Sparrow feel really sick. And that would be one thing, except a lot of times the clothes are different, the location's different, people are walking up as if they met Sparrow in a bar last night, Sparrow doesn't remember it. So Sparrow's trying to figure out what's going on with these blackout things, and then at the same time, all of a sudden people are trying to yank him into a car. And other people are coming up and saving him and then going, no, you have to come with me. So Sparrow doesn't know what the hell's going on. And this is one of those books that I feel almost is like the one you were talking about, Scott, in terms of you are just thrown headfirst into the pool and you just have to keep swimming and swimming and swimming. And as the pieces come to you, because in a sense you're like Sparrow going, I'm told just enough about this world. But as the story washes over you, you start to put together the pieces of it right behind Sparrow. And if you just keep reading and just keep treading water, it turns into this wonderful, complicated story that is really, I don't know, this is my third time reading it. And I thought, it's my third time reading it, although it's been a few years. I'll surely remember enough that I won't feel like that this time. And I almost do, though.
that's cool.
And I have since you guys were reading a little bit, I didn't know if you wanted to hear.
I would love
a
to.
A little yeah. bit. This is, Sparrow is taking somebody to spend the night at her place, or his place, I mean. And it says, home was a corner of the seventh floor and the rooftop somewhat of a big office building. Or certain things that were mine took up space on the roof. The stairway that rose out of the lobby inside the front doors was railed with ornamental cast iron and wrapped level by level around the open center of the building to the third floor, where it stopped. The back stairs were nearly rotted away. It would have been safer to climb the sandstone barehanded than to try them. The lobby elevator was ruined. The car was jammed in the shaft between the second and third floors, and the cables were ripped out. The doors were boarded shut. I was the only tenant above the third floor, because I was the only one who knew where the service elevator was, and that it worked. I saw the place with Skinner's eyes when I brought him in the side entrance. The shabby grandeur missed being romantic and fell back on pitiful. The broken black-and-white marble floor, the gouged oak wainscoting, the bits of mirror clinging to the wall above it. The hall smelled like cooked cabbage, and I heard an old man voice behind one door singing a pop song with only occasional reference to the tune.
I like that very much. I like it a lot.
You know, her name sounded familiar to me, so I looked her up. And mm-hmm. have you heard of the Borderland series?
Yes.
It's like the shared universe, kind of urban fantasy, and a whole bunch of authors write in it. And she's one of the authors on that list.
Her book Finder is from mm-hmm. that universe, and that's the only one of the Borderlands stories I've read, and I liked it. It was a touch predictable, I thought, the story. So,
yeah. So this book that you're talking about, does it have anything that's different from this kind of urban fantasy that's so popular right now, or does it feel different?
Yeah, it is an urban fantasy. You're right. I forgot to say that. But there's no you know, elves and things. Doesn't Borderland have all that stuff?
Yeah, I don't know.
I remember Finder did, I think.
Yeah, it says this, humans and magical creatures, so I imagine.
Yeah. This has magic only in that, like, people do voodoo and stuff like that.
Mm.
So it's in that... Yes, it's darker. In that sense of a connection with the spirit world, I suppose you'd say.
Okay.
And so those things are allowed to work. And that's one of the mysterious elements going on, is there's something being talked about by a lot of the people around Sparrow that Sparrow can never really kind of grab a hold of and understand what it is until about two-thirds of the way through the book. And suddenly, you know, it starts really falling into place, because then you're shown what the real overall story is. And you're just like on this roller coaster. And I have to say, the thing about Emma Bull, she wrote this, which is my favorite. She wrote a book called Territory, which sounds really weird, but it's so good. And it's in Tombstone, Arizona, before the famous shootout at the OK Corral, following two different characters in the town. And it does have magic in it, but it's like Chinese magic. And the way she does it, it is an old Western. And Jenny, I think you would like the main female character in it. And, but it also is, she works it in so perfectly with how the Tombstone story works that at the end, I was just left kissing the ground at how good she was. And then The War for the Oaks is, I think, her first book. And that one was a much more what you would think of as a traditional urban fantasy. But it was written in 1987, when that was kind of the new up and coming thing. And in that one, it's so much based around music and the creative element and the feeding on each other when you're in a band, that though it has the fae in it and fairies and that sort of thing, it's handled in such a realistic way in terms of the old way you thought of fairies. They weren't friendly and nice necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
You had to watch out. And the music is so much a part of it that by the time you get to the end of the book, where there's this huge musical conclusion as a duel sort of a thing, you're flying through the book in the same way that the music would pick you up and carry you in this situation. I don't know how she did it, but I've read that one three times, and every time I find myself racing to the end and feeling exhilarated at the end of it.
Oh, that's neat. Yeah.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Very nice. Yeah. Did you mention that Bone Dance has a subtitle? Right?
Yes, Fantasy for Technophiles.
Love that.
Yeah. That is cool.
Yeah, that's going to go on my list.
Yeah, me too.
Definitely want to, I would really like to read that one.
Mm-hmm. I might pick the music one first.
Yeah, and they're both, I just reread the music one, The War for the Oaks, and I was so pleased that I still really loved it.
Yeah. You know,
it's definitely a keeper.
Oh, that's cool.
And I've given it to both my daughters and my mother and my sister, and they all love it.
Oh, great.
So.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, Jenny, what's up?
Well, did you guys know that Margaret Atwood is writing a serial novel?
I did not.
Yeah,
it was a serial novel.
Yeah,
a serial novel like Charles Dickens used to write.
Uh-huh. Oh. Yeah, it was complete news to me, and apparently it's been going on for 2 years. And I know it's only available in ebook format, and it's called Positron. And so there are 5 episodes out. I've only read 3. I've been trying to kind of space them out because once I get to 5 and the story isn't over, it's going to drive me crazy. but I found, before I ever even read the books, I watched this video of her at the LA Book Festival where she talks about herself compared to Dickens. And the main difference that she says is that Dickens wrote really fast and she doesn't. So we get the episodes when they're done. That's it.
Yeah.
But she also talked about how back then, you know, he would write in response to how people reacted. And so if someone liked a character, he would write that character more. And I don't know if she's being that responsive, but this isn't a book that she's already finished and she's just divided it into pieces. It's a work in progress.
That's
so
neat.
It's really neat. And so I thought I'd talk a little bit about the 3 episodes I've read. They're named I'm Starved for You, Choke Collar, and Erase Me. And if they sound kind of campy, it's because it really is campy. I've labeled it a dystopian romantic comedy. And okay, so it's near future America. She likes to pick on America. And there's about 40% unemployment, really high crime, no future for anyone. And so there's this community called Consilience. And if you join it, you commit for life. But it's kind of like a self-commitment to a community you can't leave, but it ensures that you'll have food to eat and normal family suburban life. They take over places. They're never named, but you get the sense it's kind of like Detroit, places that have been abandoned en masse, and they fix the houses up. And so half the time, these two characters, Stan and Charmaine, they live as husband and wife in a little tiny house. And then the other half of the time, they have to check into a prison for voluntary incarceration. And the prison is named Positron. And so the first episode, I'm Starved for You. I guess most of the episodes are kind of 60 to 90 pages, so they're pretty short. Sam finds a note under the fridge with lipstick, like a kiss mark on it, and all it says is, I'm starved for you. And so he starts imagining the woman who wrote it, because while he and Charmaine are in prison, or Positron, there's another couple that lives in their house, but they're not allowed to communicate with them, but they know they're there. They have their storage stuff in the basement and everything. So that's kind of the catalyst for everything that happens after that. So it's really a lot of fun. It's not as serious as the Mad Adam trilogy. It's probably also not as intricate, but, it's very Atwood.
Oh, that's interesting.
This sounds like,
Julie and I read the Bleak House, or just Bleak House, not the Bleak House, but Bleak House. Wasn't that written as a serial novel too?
Yes. All his things pretty much were. Yeah.
Which is amazing. I mean, that's amazing that he didn't start out with some kind of an outline for that book. I just think that's amazing.
Well, yeah, and I think that he has a collection of letters, or his sister-in-law and daughter collected as many of his letters as they could, and I was kind of glancing through a collection of the 3 volumes, and at one point, he's like, oh, I'm trying to work this out. I can't have anybody bothering me because I'm really at this tough spot in Bleak House. And I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, you were doing that on the fly?
Yeah,
so kind of like you're saying, Jenny. But that makes me think of that premise on the Atwood book, and it's probably not at all the same, but the idea of the couple living there when they're not there and seeing, like, you know, the lipstick note or whatever, makes me think of that short story, that famous short story about the everybody's so overpopulated that they have to go into capsules and they only get to come out one day a week. And the guy is famous short story, and the guy and the girl, somehow they, you know, one's on Wednesday and one's on Saturday or something, but they start leaving notes in the log because they both work at the same place or something, and they fall in love, and they're trying to figure out how they can jigger the system because you're never allowed to change days.
What do you know what the story is?
Oh, I wish I could think of it.
Wow, that's not coming to my mind either.
Tim Mahomey, are you listening? I bet you know. Come on. I'm going to have to look for it. I think it's called, like, you know, something about Saturday or something, but I'll look for it.
Yeah, that sounds pretty nifty.
Yeah, but that book sounds interesting because I've never really, I've tried Margaret Atwood. She's just, I don't know, not, she's difficult for me.
Well, she writes all different types of books, you know? Like, I tend to like her dystopian stuff better than her just regular literary stuff. And I know some people that feel the exact opposite of that. So,
yeah.
You just have to find something you like. I mean, yeah. She's such a force. I mean, she's not young anymore, and she just continues to write and be creative and be involved. And I just don't know how I missed this. Because this has been happening while Mad Atom trilogy finished. So, I don't know. It's bizarre.
Yeah. Well, and I know it's always interesting when you find authors who write about a lot of different things or in different styles, you know, just pick up and write like that. Mm-hmm. I admire that a lot.
Yeah, me too.
So, I've tried two of her books and just went, you know what? Maybe she's not for me. So.
Yeah, you know, Stephen King wrote The Green Mile that way, too.
Really?
Serial?
Yeah. It was a serial novel, yeah.
Hmm.
He was trying, you know, to do what Dickens did. And, you know, I remember it coming out. It was like 6 parts in paperback.
Mm-hmm.
Before the internet and ebooks and things. Uh-huh. I mean, the internet was there, but ebooks really weren't. But
yeah.
But yeah, they came out in 6 really thin paperbacks.
Well, and I'm trying to picture what life would have been like, like back in Dickens' time, where maybe that was one of your only forms of entertainment and you waited for it and you kept up with it. But these days, where there's so much available, I don't know what I think about this idea.
Yeah.
I mean, because I'm going to forget, and I'll still have it, though, so I can go back and reread. How did Stephen King do it? What did he publish it in?
It seemed like it was monthly. It wasn't in a magazine. It was as a paperback.
Oh, okay.
It was like $1.95
for
a paperback that was maybe 60 to 100 pages, something like that.
And Dickens publications were monthly also.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So he had a month to get it done, get it typeset, proofed.
Yeah, King was famous enough where he didn't need a magazine. Dickens didn't either.
Well, he made a substantial amount of money from keeping that one publication going. I mean, he was a publisher after a while because, oh gosh, who was it? Elizabeth Gaskell, North and South, came out in his magazine. Because she was mad at him because she wanted to name it after the main character who, I've only listened to one episode of Craftlit on this, so I don't remember what that person's name was, but... And he was the publisher, and so behind her back, he just went, nope, North and South.
North and South.
That's what we're calling it.
It's funny. Publishers like to change titles, huh?
Yes.
I hear that story all the time where they're like, we don't like the title.
Yes, yes, they do. I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
My little tiny book that publisher will never talk to me again.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you wouldn't think so. They won on everything. They should be happy to talk to me, but no.
And that book is Happy Catholic by Julie Davis.
Oh, thank you.
Little plug.
I love that book. Yep.
Just a little book.
Just a little book. But I liked it.
Oh, it was great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So,
well,
Scott.
Next up for me, I want to talk to a book that I actually don't think either of you will like.
Okay.
But I'm just going to, I have a reason why I'd like to talk about it. There's a separate reason. But the book is called The Loon. By Michael Brent Collings. And it is a horror novel. Michael Brent Collings is a horror novelist, writes quite a bit. But the what it's about is the Loon is a lunatic asylum that there's a giant storm, huge snowstorm. I think it was in Montana. Giant snowstorm, very abnormal, huge snowstorm that cut it off from the rest of civilization. You know, and they knew it was coming and everything, so they were battening down the hatches. And the guards that are there and the, you know, a psychiatrist is there. And then it ends up that one of the guards' sister and her daughter have a family incident with her husband, who's abusive, and they run away and they end up there because they wanted to, you know, she didn't know where else to go other than where her brother was. So they're all there, and then the snow hits, and they're cut off from everything, and of course are all mayhem. Everything breaks loose in the insane asylum. So you've got a Hannibal Lecter character. Yeah, and not only that, but there is also the owner of the asylum has been experimenting in the basement.
Of course.
And has invented this Lovecraftian monster that is also creeping around during this whole thing. So I read this book and I thought it was super entertaining. It was like a movie. The chapters were really short. You know, like when you watch a Seinfeld episode, it's like every scene is like 30 seconds long. You know, when you actually watch it and try to pick it away that way,
mm-hmm.
It's like they write these little tiny scenes. And that's kind of how this book was put together. It's as if the book was written and he was going to say, you know, this would be a cool movie, you know. And that's exactly how I felt about it the whole time, is it was an entertaining horror movie. You know, not a top-notch horror movie, but an entertaining B-style horror movie, you know. So, but it's like he took all these elements of other horror movies and threw it in there, and it was a fun quick read. So again, it's called The Loon, LOON, by Michael Brent Collins. And one of the reasons why I wanted to bring it up today is because it is self-published.
Uh-huh.
And the reason that this guy is very interesting to me is because he claims to be making a comfortable living, and those are his words, self-publishing.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that was very interesting, and I would just like to talk about it for a few minutes. You know, it used to be that self-publishing always meant that you have a novelist that is not able to cut it. And this novelist is now going to self-publish. So, I mean, what do you two think of that statement? Is that something?
I agree.
It seems to me something that is true, but seems less true today.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you agree with that statement more than anything.
I still think I agree with it. Even though I know you're saying the opposite, because like even Hugh Howey, who wrote Wool, right, and it was independently published, and then when it started catching on, what happened? They turned it into a book, and they published it by, you know, a more well-known publisher. So I think, yeah. I mean, I think that's what happened. Maybe that was self-published. I'm not sure.
No, I think Wool was self-published, and I think you're exactly right.
And The Martian is
so
the same
was,
way.
Was it the same way? I didn't realize that about The Martian.
Yeah, and The Martian is, you know, on the bestseller list right now. And it was also, he wanted to sell it on the Kindle for 99 cents.
Mm-hmm.
And something about Amazon wouldn't let him. They were making him charge more, I think, now that it's published.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're saying that The Martian was self-published.
It was self-published.
And somebody discovered
it.
And
he sold
so
many copies of it that Amazon came to him and went, please, we can all make more money off of this, you know.
So is it still self-published, or did somebody pick them up?
Now it's
somebody picked them up.
Yeah.
See, it's interesting to me because I feel like if you've got a hit novel on your hands, why would you want the publisher?
They can distribute it. They can get you more money.
Yeah,
so
you're looking at a greater distribution, right?
Get it into the bookstores that everyone sees. Get the audio version made without having to pay for it.
Yeah, all that stuff.
Do it in paperback. Do it in hardback. Do it translations into other countries if it's appropriate, you know.
make it to the library.
Yeah, and the problem for me, right? You know, the biggest problem for me with self-published stuff is that, I mean, who's going to wade through all that stuff? Because I think if the rule that 90% of everything is crap, it's probably, you know, 99.9% of self-published stuff is probably not very good.
I'll go ahead.
Oh, no, it's fine.
I have to say, I get sent a lot of requests for people for review books to read. You know, oh, I'm trying to get it published. And almost all of them, you just look at it and you go, I would have to, you know, I'm not a teacher, but this is terrible. You know?
Yeah, yeah. And early on in the SFF audio days, I would get sent every now and then something in print, which always surprised me because, you know, we were audio and it was like, you know, how did they decide to send us something? And I remember one that I actually read, you know, because I took it really seriously that back then, if I got sent something, I thought that was like an honor. And I was like, well, this is, you know, they picked me to read this. I should read it.
And I remember those days.
That didn't last very long because, yeah, it's just them trying to get their book out. Right. And so I remember reading one and I felt horrible. I felt horrible for the person. But yeah, it just seems that, you know, with Amazon, you've got opportunities here. Well, one of the things that's most important to me in the traditional publishing route is editing. You know, you've got to go through this filter, you know, and at least everybody who's published has this filter. I think you've got authors that are no longer filtered. They probably need some more filtering, but I'm just saying that, especially at the beginning, it seems to me that they're edited. But we've got the rise of these independent editors all over the place, like Marissa Vu. What's her last name? Is it Van Uden?
That's right.
Is that right? Yeah. She does independent editing. And it seems almost like, you know, you could write a novel and get it edited yourself with an independent editor, someone that would work with you. And then what do you do with it? Do you go ahead and send it to a publisher and try and get through that way? Or, you know, throw it out there. But the problem is audience. And Michael Brent Collings, he goes to conventions and he's on panels and things. And it's almost like, you know, I'm going to meet as many people as I possibly can. And maybe they'll buy one of my books.
I agree that there's that question of who's going to wade through all that stuff. I don't trust a lot of that self-published stuff that you see that everybody's bought.
Right. Now, we read a self-published book, didn't we? Wasn't Assam and Darjeeling self-published?
Oh, yeah, it was.
But there was a hit.
But I had listened to that beforehand as it came out on iTunes.
Ah, okay.
I had fallen in
love. So you were listening to a podcast. That's where we found it.
And then
he
turned it into a book, and I was super excited. And then there's another author, Mike Bennett, who's, I think he's in the middle of this very long book called Underwood and Flinch, which was just gruesome enough about some very evil vampires that I had to quit listening fairly early on. But he's done a bunch of short stories and some novels all in the horror genre, and I think those, at least one of those has been published.
Yeah.
But he started by getting it out in podcasting.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Well, and I think
I
think there's a difference to me too between self-publishing and indie publishing. And I have seen people like Publishers Weekly making a really big effort to try to review indie publishers lately. But even then, I'm like looking at the author names, I don't recognize them. Looking at the covers, their art isn't very good, and I don't know. I still have a hard time wanting to pick the books up. I don't know what it is.
Yeah,
maybe I trust the standard publishing world too much. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't think that I would read a self-published book unless somebody said, this is good. Somebody told me that.
Yeah, but someone has to be that first reader.
Right, and that's a hard thing. And, you know, how do you get that done?
Yeah, because you know, as you were saying, Jenny, that one, gosh, that one was like 99 cents or something for the trilogy during one of those sample deals. And I picked it up because I'd seen started to see people on Goodreads mention it. I was surprised at how good it was.
Yeah, it was really good.
Yeah, and that holds up with my theory that if you're a writer and you write something really good, I think people are going to find that. You know, you talk to people who would like to publish all the time who say, you know, boy, I can't break through, I can't get this and all that. And then, you know, somebody might end up self-publishing for that reason, because they can't break through. That's probably the wrong reason to self-publish, right? It's like, I just want to see my book, you know?
But you don't know that. You can't be
Yeah, you don't know that. Objective. But you can't. You can't. It's hard to be objective as the writer. It's impossible.
And I know I was talking to Mike Aquilina one time, who's a very prolific Catholic author. And mm-hmm. he was saying, you know, he doesn't have trouble. He can get deals with Random House or the major Catholic publishers. But he was saying he's more and more advising people to try self-publishing. He said, you know, I can help people find editors. And, you know, if you want something more than a basic layout, I know people to refer you to. He said, but it's really hard to break down that door to a publisher, because the publishers are all hedging their bets because they don't know what to do because of e-books and everything.
Right, right. So, yeah, so I don't know if the answer to, you know, how to get started has changed or what, but it does seem that I've heard this story many times. The wool story is, you know, 50 Shades of Grey? What's that book? Isn't that the same thing?
Oh, was it?
Wasn't that a self-published book? In fact, I heard that was actually fan fiction. That was a fan fiction, Twilight fan fiction that people really liked, so she changed the names in it.
I've ignored it. You know,
and this is hearsay, and here I am saying it on a podcast as if it's truth, and I don't honestly know if that's the truth or not. 40 Shades of Grey. How many shades of gray?
We don't care.
We don't care how many shades of gray. But anyway, that story, you know, these books that come out, you know, people find them, people read them, and then didn't Scalzi, Agent to the Stars, wasn't that on his blog?
Oh.
And the publisher said, take that down. We would like to buy that, please.
Well,
I'm pretty sure that's how he started, too.
And I think really that's probably the key more than anything else is he wrote that, or whoever, all these people wrote it because they had that story to tell. Yeah, you know, they had something they were passionate about telling for whatever reason. And there is a lot of dreck out there, but there are the good ones that shine enough and get noticed somehow.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's a podcast, a blog, or whatever.
Right. So the road to happiness, if you're a writer, might just be to write what makes you happy, and if you're passionate about it, write it and throw it out there for people to read and
go to conventions.
Go to conventions.
Yeah. Well, and there are,
I don't know.
There's a famous quote from somebody who says, you know, anybody who doesn't write for money is a sucker, you know. Mm-hmm. But unless you're trying to make that your main way of making a living, and I don't think most people are. John Grisham started writing, getting up at 4 a.m. and writing on a legal pad before he'd go off to a full day of work at the law offices.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he just had that story he wanted to write. He wasn't doing it because he wanted to retire necessarily. And if it hadn't gotten published, would he have still been happy he wrote it? I have to feel like yes.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. So that wasn't it.
Yeah,
right?
If that's your creative expression, then if you are good at it and get a good editor and all those other things, then great, you get published. And if not, if you're not happy with what you're doing anyway, to just do it to make money, you better be hired by somebody already. Because that's how you get things like, I'm sorry, I'm going to say it, Twilight and some of that stuff, where it's written to a formula. And it's obvious. That's what the publishers all want.
It is what the publishers all want. And that opens up a whole other thing. It's like, if you were to write something that's unclassifiable, like, they would have no idea where to put it on a shelf because it doesn't match a genre, let's say, then what do you do with that book? You know, it's like a publisher's like, I don't know. But anyway, I was, you know, saw some conversation about that topic too. And anyway, it's just interesting. You know, it just seems things are changing so fast. I really don't know how it's all going to end up. But it seems like the publishers are kind of a filter. I'm not sure what's going to happen if that filter goes away.
Well, there didn't used to be as much of a filter. I mean, think what, again, mm-hmm. talking about Dickens, he published, was it A Christmas Carol himself? Because no one would publish it. He wasn't well enough known yet.
Yeah, well, there's an example. I mean, how could a publisher not want... It's like, how come Firefly got canceled? You know what I mean? It's just, I just don't understand people, and they're making these decisions. And you got to think that there's stuff out there that's just amazing that no one is touching. And, you know, there's no way we'd ever find it.
Well, that's why Joss Whedon did Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog, was to show the mm-hmm. networks that you could do something and people would be interested, even if it wasn't on TV.
Yeah.
Just internet.
Yeah.
So...
And he did that.
Yeah, but we're just in a state of flux. And, you know, 50, 100 years from now, everybody will look back and go, oh, yeah, that was like mm-hmm. when they were changing from radio to TV. And that was like, you know, just it will all settle down. People will try all kinds of things.
I wonder where it'll all end up. That's really the point of this whole thing is how is this all going to end up?
We don't know.
People are writing decent stuff and putting it out there by themselves and. You know, don't know how to find it, don't know, not willing to wade through all the dreck to get to it.
Yeah, but that's,
but still interesting.
That's what podcasts like this are good for. That's what Goodreads is good for. That's what even looking at Amazon reviews is good for.
Right, so here I am.
The favorite and the horrible, you know, the good and the bad.
You
can get a feel for it. And I mean, we've got more information about that stuff than ever.
That's for sure.
So, Scott, you have just provided us with a service because you have reviewed a self-published book.
That's right. Here I am talking about Michael Brent Collins.
That's right.
Yeah.
So his strategy worked.
And I enjoyed it. I honestly did enjoy it. It was, you know, it's not a 5-star book or anything like that. It was just fun.
Yeah.
I would have, if this had been a movie, I would have probably enjoyed it.
Yeah. Well, and let's not forget that how that all started was that he emailed me because of the SFF audio thing.
Yeah. And he's a local to me too.
Oh, I know, but he was self-promoting too. So I think part of self-publishing means you have to be willing to put the time in to self-promote, which must take so much time.
It must take quite a bit of time. Yeah. It must.
Oh, yeah.
It must.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
so cool.
And also I would say the other thing is when you're saying just a fun book, mm-hmm. sometimes those just fun books, they don't have to be the best fun book ever. I mean, I just finished listening to the audio of Agent to the Stars, which you mentioned.
Yeah.
That's the same way. It's I gave it 3 stars, and Tam said, only 3 stars? Because I was like, I love this book. And I'm like, it's a big, juicy hamburger. You know? It's not a French meal, mm-hmm. but it's the best hamburger ever. It's just fun.
Yeah, and you know, the star rating systems are difficult sometimes, because I gave... But The Crying of Lot 49, 3 stars. I would give The Loon 3 stars. You know what I mean? They teach The Crying of Lot 49 in college. I don't think they're teaching The Loon in college. It's almost like, you know, two different kinds of thing.
Your review had better be pretty careful about what they're going to get for that 3 stars. Oh, I like The Loon.
It's
let me try
like,
the
yeah, it's like, how can you put that? And I've talked to you before about the difficulty of reviewing things like Catholic books, like things that are, you know, really important to me. It's like, how can I review that on the same scale that I just did The Loon on, you know, or even The Crying of Lot 49? It's like, it's a totally different 5-star scale.
Well, for me, I just decided that the stars were how a book felt or meant to me. So mm-hmm. 5 stars means I wanted to give it away to everyone, mm-hmm. you know, and read every other book the author wrote. 4 stars means I would read more books by this author. Often 3 stars is kind of like the, well, it was fine, you know, in all types of genres, it was fine. But
I kind of went back to looking at what their definition was on Goodreads, because you hover over it and it was amazing.
Yeah, and that's what I tried.
It was really great. It was good. It was fine. I didn't like it, and I'm like, that's why it was fine it was good. It was good. I can love a good book without, like you say, Jenny, wanting to give it to everybody I know.
Right, or write a fan letter before you get up off the couch, which I have done before.
Oh, what a good girl.
I love it.
I hear that enthusiasm.
Well, and I found out later that the book had gotten so much negative press that the author refused to discuss it with anyone. And so I don't think my letter probably helped. But my letter was the opposite. My letter was gushy.
She probably has it under her pillow.
I hope so.
Well, cool. All right. Back to Julie, right?
Yeah, well, this was the one Jenny and I were emailing earlier today. I was like, those first two are a lock. The third one I had like 8 candidates for. I managed to slide Agent to the Stars in there. Did you notice that was very clever?
Yep, yeah, well done, yeah, well done.
But I'm going to go with nonfiction at this point.
Oh,
right.
Yeah, going to break the mold a little. This is a book called The Kitchen Diaries, A Year in the Kitchen with Nigel Slater. Nigel Slater is a British cookbook writer, and he started off, I think, doing maybe a restaurant review column, but definitely just a food writing column for one of the newspapers. And now I think he's got, you know, the TV show and all these things. But he is one of these writers who he's wonderfully descriptive, and he's a big fan of cooking without worrying about, is it a teaspoon of this or a teaspoon and a fourth of this? He'll say, take 4 hot red chilies and do this. Then take about a pound of pork and do this. And then take a handful of cilantro and do this. And he likes you to get in the kitchen and just cook without having to worry about getting it right, so that you get a feel for it. And on baking recipes, obviously, he's more specific because you have to be for cakes and things or they don't turn out. But this kitchen diary was just him saying, for a year, I'm just going to kind of keep a journal of what I do. And so you might go 3 or 4 days in March, say, where there's nothing. He forgot to write anything down. And then he'll have one where he says, wow, it was really cold today. And he'll describe what the garden looked like. And luckily, on the way home from work, I was stopped off and picked this stuff up and I made these things. And then he'll put the recipes for him. And there's this gorgeous color photography on this kind of cream colored paper. So it's wonderful looking, but it's a bit muted. It's not that real hit you in the face food photography. And then he also then we'll have, he's honest, the next day he'll have things where he'll say, well, I was going to cook 3 or 4 things, but after all that cooking yesterday, I didn't want to, and then I forgot I didn't have any food in the house, so I had to nip down to like the 7-Eleven and get baked beans and toast.
Oh, I know.
That's what we had for dinner. So he's not proud either. He's practical. And I like to, I've read this through, I devoured it once, haha, and then I kept it in my bathroom for a year, or, you know, next to my sink when I'd brush my teeth and stuff, and I kind of read through it during the year as inspiration for me, since I'm the meal planner in the household. And every time I ask my husband, well, what do you think you might like? And he's always like, oh, everything you make is good. And I'm just like, this is no help at all. No help at all.
What does Nigel do?
What?
And then you say, what does Nigel do?
Yeah, I know, exactly. Well, and I can look through and go, oh, that's right. This is seasonal at this time of year. I hadn't thought of, you know, rhubarb or whatever. So that's the kind of stuff that I ignore when I'm walking through the store and just on my automatic shopping. And so I was doing it again this year because I kind of just like going through the year with Nigel. So I thought I'd mention it.
That's neat.
Yeah.
I think one of these years I'm going to have to add diaries and journals to my reading goals.
Oh, my gosh.
Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah, that's a good idea.
I could read a bunch of them throughout the year as the year, you know. Oh, this is a good idea.
Yeah, that is, because I liked it. Well, and that's kind of what I did with Flannery O'Connor's letters, because it was such a huge book, and you didn't want to sit down and just read through 500 pages of letters at once, but
right.
That was kind of what lived by my, you know, where I'd brush my teeth and stuff, or I'd read a few letters, and then you'd take the book to bed or into breakfast, whichever direction you were going, for the bathroom, and go, I'm going to read a few more.
Mm. So, come on, Flannery, let's have some breakfast.
Is a good idea.
Yeah. That is a good idea.
That's a good one.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks very, very much.
No, you're very, very welcome.
Yes. Jenny, what's next?
Okay, well, I also debated for a long time about my third book. But for some reason this month, I've been listening to a ton of audiobooks. Well, in this past month. My brain's been more geared toward listening than reading words. So I've had some really, really great experiences. So this is a line from it, and then I will tell you what it is. I was sad that summer was over, but I was happy that it was over for my enemies, too. So it's called One More Thing, Stories and Other Stories by B.J. Novak.
Oh, my gosh, B.J. Novak from The Office.
Yeah, from The Office. We know him right? as the intern on the American version of The Office.
And he wrote a lot of that. He was one of the
main writers. Absolutely. Yeah. And he also was speaking on my campus tonight, but I was here instead.
What?
Isn't that crazy?
You missed B.J. Novak for us?
I did.
We could have moved it.
Well, it's one of those student events that I'm sure was going to be full. So it's more important for them. But you know how sometimes the audio version of something it just adds so much to the book?
Mm-hmm.
This is one of those cases for sure.
Oh, cool.
Because there are 60 stories-ish. In this, and some of them are like two sentences.
So
I know it's so many, and each track is a different story, at least the version I was listening to. So sometimes they'll be like 11 seconds, and sometimes they'll be 32 minutes. So it really, it's really different, depending. And the audio is performed by the author, but also Rainn Wilson and Mindy Kaling, also from The Office. Mm-hmm. And Lena Dunham ends up on a few. Emma Thompson ends up on a few. And then there's some other people in there, too.
Oh, that's fun.
So I thought I would just talk about some of my favorites. There's one called Julie and the Warlord. And, like a Congo warlord. Congo. And there's actually another version of it on This American Life. But I like the version on the audiobook with Lena Dunham. You know, she's the actress and creator and writer for Girls, if you know that show on HBO. She just has a really great tone, but it's so funny because they're on a date, like a first date, and they've talked online, but it's the first time they're having dinner in person. And so in between this discussion about pillaging and murder, and they're like, oh, what would you like for dessert? So it's just really funny. Let's see. There's a story called Sophia. It's about a sex robot who falls in love. And she's the first sentient robot. And the guy takes her back because that's too much pressure. there's a story called Closure. And I don't want to spoil it, but it's kind of about the lengths someone wanted to go to achieve closure of a relationship. And one of the shortest stories is one of my favorites. It's called The Beautiful Girl in the Bookstore. And it ends with the line, she loved him, but she never quite got over the suspicion that she was just his favorite thing in the bookstore. So it's so cute. And I, sometimes when people who are famous write things, I don't want to read them because I'm just pretty sure they're going to be awful. Mm-hmm. I've had that experience multiple times. James Franco, and sorry, James, if you're listening, but you're not a good writer. But this, B.J. Novak's a writer first, and it really shows, and I really enjoyed it. I've actually gone back and re-listened to some of them, and I don't usually re-listen to things.
Oh, that's neat.
Are they all amusing stories, or are some of them serious?
Yeah, it's really varied.
Okay.
Yeah, but there's a lot of humor in it, but some of it's very dry humor. So, mm-hmm. It's good. It's a good balance.
Well, yeah, and you said Mindy Kaling, because I listened to her audiobook of her read her own audiobook, which I didn't think would be good. We loved it. My husband and I listened to it on a car trip last summer. Hmm. We both really liked it. So,
yeah, that's one of the books I have on my, maybe I should buy this now. I don't want to buy it. Maybe I should buy that list.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, now I'm going to have to add this one because this sounds good. I didn't ever really watch The Office, but I like a lot of the talent that was on it. You know?
Well, I think
so.
I think there's something.
I was really impressed with The Office. I thought it was really good.
Yeah, me too.
The last season or so, they had lost their way, but I think that's the way. That's American television, isn't it? They run until they just can't go anymore.
Yeah, and we didn't start watching it when, by the time we kind of paid attention to it, it was several seasons in, and I think you probably needed to start at the beginning. And
Yeah, I think
we just did with Parks
starting
and Rec.
Starting at the beginning on that show is more important than most, I would say.
Yeah.
You get to see that.
Eventually, someday, we'll get back to it.
Yep, yep. Cool. Yeah, and I know that BJ Novak had a huge part of that. I don't know if he was the showrunner or not, but he was huge in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, good. Well, good.
Okay. Well, Scott, one last book.
Well, for my last book, it's one I have not yet finished, but I'm going to talk about it anyways because, I'm down here in Florida. I'm working all the time. It's crazy. But I am enjoying this book a lot, and I actually heard about it through Julie, who passed it on to me because I think it was recommended to you. And then you said, well, that sounds like Scott might enjoy it. And you passed it to me, and I appreciate that very much.
Oh, you're welcome. I can't wait to hear.
It's called The Cold Dish.
Oh, right, right.
By Craig Johnson.
Yes.
And I laughed out loud because the very first line, there's a quote at the beginning of the book. And I'm listening to it on audio, read by George Guidall, who is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
But at the very beginning, there's a quote. And the quote is, revenge is a dish that is best served cold. And I said, well, that's from Star Trek. But apparently, before Star Trek, it was in some French book.
Yeah, I think that was quoted from someone.
Yeah, so, I laughed and it said, this is from blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, no, it is not.
Khan said that, by the way.
What is wrong with you?
You know all your literature references from Star Trek.
That's right.
Someone's got to keep.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. That's a Star Trek quote, not Dickens.
Captain Kirk read it out
That's
loud.
Right. Come on, people. Anyway, The Cold Dish is one of those, it's a mystery novel. And I think most of these mystery novels, the mystery is almost secondary. The series,
mm-hmm.
The mystery is almost secondary. You like them, or I like them, because of the people. I'm thinking of some of the other books, like James Lee Burke's books.
Mm-hmm.
I still like those. I've read probably four or five of those. I've never finished a series like this to the end, ever. I think that these are called Longmire mysteries. Is that?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the Walt Longmire mysteries. And I think there's like 10 of them. But The Cold Dish is Craig Johnson's first novel. And the main character is a sheriff in Wyoming, I believe. Yeah, Absaroka County, Wyoming. So he's the sheriff, keeps getting elected. He has a really good friend who's an Indian that owns a bar. And one of the scenes I remember was he goes into this bar and the Indian is looking for a circuit breaker, but the circuit breakers are under the floorboard. So he keeps pulling up the floorboards looking for the breaker. And it's really old under there and, it's all, rusted out and everything, and they're discussing, will a penny work?
Yeah.
It's just funny. And then he's got a deputy who's female named Vic. And I noticed the name Longmire seemed familiar to me, and I found out that the reason is because I've seen commercials for it. It's a TV series on, I think, AMC. I'm not positive. I didn't look that up.
Okay.
But Kara, the lady that played Starbuck on Battlestar Galactica, she plays the deputy.
Okay.
And I don't recognize the fellow who plays the main character, but Henry Standing Bear, which is his Indian friend, is played by Lou Diamond Phillips.
Oh, okay.
So it's got such really good reviews that I think that after I finish the novel, I'll check out the first season. And I have no idea if the first season's the first book or if they just took these characters and are doing a season of TV. I have no idea. But the story of this novel is I laugh out loud constantly when I'm listening to this because they're in a really small town in Wyoming, and I have lived for the last 15 years or so in a really small town in Idaho, and the similarities are just striking. It just makes me laugh out loud. Like, there's one time he, as the sheriff, he feels obligated to go to events where, I forgot exactly what he called them, but there are certain events that you just go to if you expect to get votes. You need... you know, you need to go to these events, even though he doesn't want to, he does. And he goes to the events and, you know, people see him there and they're like, hey, would you be the ghost of Christmas past in my day? And, you know, I just laugh out loud because that's, you know, you don't have to say anything. And how many times have I heard those words, you know, you don't have to say anything. We just need someone to point. That's all we need. You know, so, but the story is, you know, somebody found a dead body out on one of the fields, and, you know, the sheriff really doesn't want to go out there himself, so he gets Vic to do it, and then realizes, oh my, you know, he's got a murder on his hands, and the kid that was murdered was in a past crime that he got away with that had to do with a girl who has mental issues. There was a group of boys that got off, and he was one of them. And so there's what the cold dish is. And again, I have not finished the book yet, but I'm going to, and I'm sure we'll find out, you know, who's doing that. So, but again, the reason that I like these kind of books is because of the characters.
Yeah.
Do you guys have a favorite? Do either of you follow any series of this type?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, would you have a favorite?
Oh, well, I read all the Agatha Christies, so I love Miss Marple. And, you know, we haven't read this, but someday we will. The Alexander McCall Smith's African detective, Precious Ramotswe. I read the first 10 or 12 of those. And like you, you know, they just keep going. And eventually you go, I've read enough of these now. I'm not a friend anymore. Or
that's how I am. Books, with James Lee Burke, I think he's such an incredible writer. That's why I like him so much. But he's got this character, Dave Robichaux, and his books can be pretty violent.
I recall.
Didn't we read The Neon Rain? I think we read the first one. For a good story.
Yeah, where they go up to Montana. Was that the first one? Yeah. Okay, I couldn't remember.
Sure. Yeah. And then Heaven's Prisoners and all that. But yeah, I read some of those, and sometimes I get on a little run and I'll read two or three and then I'll stop. He's up to like 20 or something like that, so I'll never catch him.
I think the only thing even close that I read are the Frenny Fisher books. Do you guys know those?
Mm-hmm. No.
Frenny Fisher is a kind of a girl detective in Melbourne in the 1920s. And it's not like it's her profession or anything. She just always gets called into these these cases. You know, so it's like a cozy, little cozy mysteries. They're not very violent and not very gory because I just can't stand that kind of stuff. I was reading the Nevada Bar novels for a while, the Anna Pigeon mysteries, where each one's in a different national park. But they just started getting too violent for me, so I had to stop.
Yeah, I tried one of those, and I just didn't care for it that much. But you made me think just now of, for a long time, I read the Janet Ivanovich stories.
Oh, yeah.
About Stephanie Plum.
Is that the ones with the letters or the numbers?
No, neither one.
Mm-hmm.
I guess they're called, one for the money, two for whatever. But basically, she's like the world's worst bounty hunter, but she always has one serious case and just one ludicrous case she's trying to track these people down. And I think I read about 13 or 14 of those. And then about the third time looping around on which guy was she going to pick, you know, the solid guy who she'd liked when she was a kid or the bad boy ranger. And I went, no, you should have done this several books ago. I don't care anymore. Stay single forever.
Yeah.
But they were really funny. And they were kind of like you're saying, you know, there might be a bit of violence, but they were just hilarious, you know, because you didn't expect all these things. So on the Longmire books, I found those via Amy H. Sturgis. I don't know if you follow her.
I do.
On Goodreads. Yeah. And she said that when she's like worked her way up through like number 10 or something, she is just chowing down on these things and liking them a lot. And she said that usually if she sees a TV show and she finds out it's based on a series, she'll read the series first. But these were so good that she just went ahead and watched them. She couldn't stop herself. And then she went back and got the books and said, there's no way they can be that good. Oh my gosh. She said they were.
Oh, wow, that's cool.
So
yeah, and I sure am enjoying them. And it looks like A&E is this the network, not AMC.
Yeah,
A&E is where The Walking Dead is, I think. You know what's funny about The Walking Dead is that I've never seen it on TV.
Oh, do you?
I see it only on the computer,
stream
yeah.
Stream it or whatever.
It's funny. I don't even know, have any idea what channel it's on.
Now, The Walking Dead is AMC.
Right. So, is it really?
Yeah, so you haven't
played. Okay, so I'm getting mixed up. But I'm pretty sure that this book, I'm looking at a book cover on penguin.com, and I'm pretty sure it says an A&E series.
Oh, yeah, you're right. I looked it up, too.
Is it? Okay, mm-hmm. Good. Okay. So, yeah, so not the same network as The Walking Dead.
It's funny to me, though, because you're saying that you read this type of novel for the characters, and I sometimes read crime or mysteries because of the place, too. Like, mm-hmm. you can find things set almost anywhere. There were a few that I read. I think the author's name was Aaron Hart, and they were all set up in Ireland, and there would be bog bodies. And it was all about figuring out, like, because bog bodies are preserved for a long time, so it was like a archaeological mystery almost.
Yeah.
Like, is this a current death or is it an old death? They had to do all this investigating to figure it out. And then there's another series that I read called the Tea Shop Mysteries, that because they're set in Charleston, and I love Charleston.
Yes.
And there are little recipes in there, and, you know. So, like, I'm not really reading the very gritty ones.
Well, no, yeah. And those are, when you said that, I suddenly went, oh, yes. Because if I see books that are set in New Orleans, I love New Orleans so much that I will try almost any book just for the environment. Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's cool to do that.
Yeah, that is neat. Yeah, Robichaud spends time in New Orleans.
Yes, his are quite gritty. And
yeah, they are.
I read two or three more, and then I went, you know what? That's enough. I don't want the swamp.
That's enough of those.
Yes, I can get those other places, by the way.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, fun. Well, this was a lot of fun, the whole thing.
It was. What a lot of interesting, different books.
Yeah. And thank you very much for being on this podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
Thank you.
Of course. Heck yeah. So. But good deal. So did everybody finish their sidecars?
Hey, I had...
Anybody need another round?
I'm totally going to get one next time.
Oh, me too.
Yeah, go to my cooking blog. I've got several cocktails there.
Oh, really?
And what is the cooking blog's name?
Huh?
Go ahead and say the name of the blog.
Oh, Meanwhile Back in the Kitchen.
That's right. Meanwhile Back in the Kitchen.
I'll send you the link.